Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books. Written by Sean Houghton. Test 3. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers onto the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear a charity director called Adele being interviewed about volunteerism on the radio.
What is it about voluntourism that you are so against, Adele?
I don't want to phrase it quite so strongly as that. I am not wholesale against the practice, in the sense that I think most people who go volunteering do so with good, not ill, intentions. However, I believe their efforts are misplaced. There are, unquestionably, a lot of very worthwhile charitable organisations for whom I would urge people to volunteer, provided, of course, that they have the prerequisite skill set. However, and this is the crucial difference, please bear in mind that voluntourism is a business. It is profit-driven.
But surely, irrespective of the fact that the bottom line is profit, as it is nowadays for most things in this world, aren't voluntourists themselves in their actions facilitating a better world to some extent?
This is the other issue I have, because, contrariwise, I think, the vast majority of the time, what they are doing is damaging for the local communities they aim to assist. For instance, most voluntourists don't have the specific skill set required to really help. Instead, they end up doing kind of quasi-work placements where they actually have to learn the skills required to contribute. But locals could be learning these skills instead, and their contribution would be permanent. What's more, it would be providing them with hireable skills, empowering them and giving them the independence that they lack to break through the glass ceiling of poverty. Essentially, but unintentionally, what is happening is a form of job stealing.
What is it about voluntourism that you are so against, Adele?
I don't want to phrase it quite so strongly as that. I am not wholesale against the practice, in the sense that I think most people who go volunteering do so with good, not ill, intentions. However, I believe their efforts are misplaced. There are, unquestionably, a lot of very worthwhile charitable organisations for whom I would urge people to volunteer, provided, of course, that they have the prerequisite skill set. However, and this is the crucial difference, please bear in mind that voluntourism is a business. It is profit-driven.
But surely, irrespective of the fact that the bottom line is profit, as it is nowadays for most things in this world, aren't voluntourists themselves in their actions facilitating a better world to some extent?
This is the other issue I have, because, contrariwise, I think, the vast majority of the time, what they are doing is damaging for the local communities they aim to assist. For instance, most voluntourists don't have the specific skill set required to really help. Instead, they end up doing kind of quasi-work placements where they actually have to learn the skills required to contribute. But locals could be learning these skills instead, and their contribution would be permanent. What's more, it would be providing them with hireable skills, empowering them and giving them the independence that they lack to break through the glass ceiling of poverty. Essentially, but unintentionally, what is happening is a form of job stealing.
Extract 2. You will hear a fitness expert called Pamela being interviewed on a radio program.
So, Pamela, what is HIIT?
High Intensity Interval Training, or HIIT as it's better known, is a form of gym workout in which you exercise very intensively for very short spurts.
And is it effective? Reports seem to suggest so, and it is certainly all the rage in gyms around the country at the moment.
Well, to a point, all training is effective in the sense that any exercise is better than none. However, I wouldn't put too much weight in such reports. They're often funded and commissioned by vested interests. The results are almost a foregone conclusion. Besides, recently, there have been a series of independent reports favouring more traditional, low-intensity workout sessions. In other words, exercising at an average intensity for a longer period of time.
So are you against HIIT and saying we should revert to more traditional methods of working out?
Not entirely. Exercise is a very personal thing. Some people, for example, will find the gym a distasteful place to work out. So for them, HIIT is ruled out anyway, as it is, generally speaking, gym-based. However, as I alluded to before, all exercise can be beneficial. HIIT, though, given its intensity, is not for everyone. Personally, I would favour more traditional, less intensive methods. And research on the whole suggests they get at least as good results. But as many HIIT advocates have shown, it can be a very effective training technique. So this is not simply a fad or craze that will disappear. It has merits. However, I think the average person is more likely to continue exercising and getting the benefits, therefore, if their regime is less intensive and more easily sustainable. A lot of us arrive home in the evening exhausted after work. We do not have the appetite to further exhaust ourselves at the gym. This is not realistically sustainable, and it may well put many people off altogether.
So, Pamela, what is HIIT?
High Intensity Interval Training, or HIIT as it's better known, is a form of gym workout in which you exercise very intensively for very short spurts.
And is it effective? Reports seem to suggest so, and it is certainly all the rage in gyms around the country at the moment.
Well, to a point, all training is effective in the sense that any exercise is better than none. However, I wouldn't put too much weight in such reports. They're often funded and commissioned by vested interests. The results are almost a foregone conclusion. Besides, recently, there have been a series of independent reports favouring more traditional, low-intensity workout sessions. In other words, exercising at an average intensity for a longer period of time.
So are you against HIIT and saying we should revert to more traditional methods of working out?
Not entirely. Exercise is a very personal thing. Some people, for example, will find the gym a distasteful place to work out. So for them, HIIT is ruled out anyway, as it is, generally speaking, gym-based. However, as I alluded to before, all exercise can be beneficial. HIIT, though, given its intensity, is not for everyone. Personally, I would favour more traditional, less intensive methods, and research on the whole suggests they get at least as good results. But as many HIIT advocates have shown, it can be a very effective training technique. So this is not simply a fad or craze that will disappear. It has merits. However, I think the average person is more likely to continue exercising and getting the benefits, therefore, if their regime is less intensive and more easily sustainable. A lot of us arrive home in the evening exhausted after work. We do not have the appetite to further exhaust ourselves at the gym. This is not realistically sustainable. And it may well put many people off altogether.
Extract 3. You will hear a professor called Victor talking about the hunting methods of the San Bushmen, a native African nomadic tribe.
Most fascinating about my time with the San Bushmen was to learn the manner in which they traditionally hunt. Sadly, they could only demonstrate, as their particular method has been, for all intents and purposes, outlawed in this country now. It is not illegal as such, but targeting animals in the wild is, so, basically, they might as well be banned from leading their traditional way of life. That in itself is very unjust and a great shame. However, it is perhaps a necessary evil, because wild animal population numbers have reduced dramatically, though the part the Bushmen played in causing this is minuscule. Their hunting numbers are barely a drop in the ocean of the total killed. So I was afforded only a demonstration, yet, nonetheless, I marvelled at what I witnessed. Their ability to locate potential prey is the most impressive thing of all, perhaps, and I was left bewildered by their methods. They could see signs on the ground that I was quite certain they were imagining, until, lo and behold, we indeed came across the animal in question, time and again. Clearly, therefore, luck had little to do with it. What also struck me was their conditioning. As I tracked them on a motorized vehicle, electric, so as to be quiet and not interfere, these men essentially followed and outlasted wild beasts. Their method is incredible. They have little chance of beating the animals with acceleration, so they basically do so with stamina. This is not a game of stealth, but a game of attrition. Astonishingly, the Bushmen win. Most fascinating about my time with the San Bushmen was to learn the manner in which they traditionally hunt. Sadly, they could only demonstrate, as their particular method has been, for all intents and purposes, outlawed in this country now. It is not illegal as such, but targeting animals in the wild is, so, basically, they might as well be banned from leading their traditional way of life. That in itself is very unjust and a great shame. However, it is perhaps a necessary evil, because wild animal population numbers have reduced dramatically, though the part the Bushmen played in causing this is minuscule. Their hunting numbers are barely a drop in the ocean of the total killed. So I was afforded only a demonstration, yet, nonetheless, I marvelled at what I witnessed. Their ability to locate potential prey is the most impressive thing of all, perhaps, and I was left bewildered by their methods. They could see signs on the ground that I was quite certain they were imagining, until, lo and behold, we indeed came across the animal in question, time and again. Clearly, therefore, luck had little to do with it. What also struck me was their conditioning. As I tracked them on a motorized vehicle, electric, so as to be quiet and not interfere, these men essentially followed and outlasted wild beasts. Their method is incredible. They have little chance of beating the animals with acceleration, so they basically do so with stamina. This is not a game of stealth, but a game of attrition. Astonishingly, the Bushmen win.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a radio presenter called Giles Franklin discussing a weather phenomenon known as a fog bow. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
And that's tomorrow's forecast for you. But before I say cheerio, one of our listeners sent in a marvellous photograph today of a very unusual phenomenon, a white rainbow, inquiring as to what exactly it is. We've uploaded the photo to our website and social networks, and due to the immense amount of interest we've had since, by way of comments and likes, I just wanted to take this opportunity to explain what exactly people are seeing in the image. Although it is sometimes called a white rainbow, and indeed it is a similar weather phenomenon to that of the rainbow in most respects, a fogbow, as the arc in the photo is more commonly known, is, as the name suggests, notably different to behold. Fogbow is the preferred name because using the term white rainbow is actually somewhat inaccurate. From a distance, and without careful examination, a fogbow may indeed appear completely white. However, this is not so. Whilst the bow only consists of weak colours, it has more than one of them, including a reddish outer edge and a bluish inner one. The reasons the colours are so weak as compared with a typical rainbow is due to the dimensions of the water droplets that cause fog, which are considerably smaller than those produced by other forms of precipitation. Indeed, in many cases, the water droplets are so small that the entire fog bow can appear white. There is a direct correlation between the droplet size and colour vivacity, you see, so the smaller the droplets, the weaker the colours. However, a closer inspection will reveal that, though faint, the colours are present. No fog bow is ever, therefore, in the strictest sense, a white rainbow. Because fog is essentially low cloud, it is hardly surprising that the phenomenon is also frequently visible from aircrafts, typically when they are flying above clouds, looking downwards, if you like. Such fog bows are often given the alternative name cloud bows, for obvious reasons. Another name for fog bows was given to them by mariners, who tend to encounter the phenomenon regularly out at sea. To them, they are sea dogs. Fog bows are also occasionally visible at night time, when they are known as lunar fog bows. But why does droplet size have such an impact on coloration? Well, as I may have mentioned, fog bows are formed in much the same way as rainbows. Here are the basic steps. First, white light enters the water droplet. As it does so, it is divided into its seven different colors due to a process called dispersion. The different colours of light refract or change direction after entering the droplet at slightly different rates. Therefore, when the seven separate waves of light then get reflected off the inside of the droplet, they each go in a similar but slightly different direction, emerging to form the familiar large, colourful arc of the rainbow. The difference with fog bows is that the light is not refracted, however. Whilst refraction is at work in large water droplets to change the direction of light, the tiny droplets found in fog cause light to diffract instead. In simple terms, the process of diffraction involves breaking the light waves up and spreading them out into many different directions. The diffracted light produces weaker colours and the familiar broader and paler arc of the fog bow. Knowing what we do now about fog bows, it's unsurprising, therefore, that the photographer who captured the striking image that provoked such interest when we posted it on our website and forums was in the Scottish Highlands at the time of capture. After all, fog is a very frequent weather event in mountainous and hilly regions where there are often stark temperature contrasts. For the same reason, spectacular fog bows are regularly seen over Arctic waters too. Indeed, if you find you now have a taste for fog bows and a hankering to find more, you'd do well.
Now you will hear part two again.
And that's tomorrow's forecast for you. But before I say cheerio, one of our listeners sent in a marvellous photograph today of a very unusual phenomenon, a white rainbow, inquiring as to what exactly it is. We've uploaded the photo to our website and social networks, and due to the immense amount of interest we've had since, by way of comments and likes, I just wanted to take this opportunity to explain what exactly people are seeing in the image. Although it is sometimes called a white rainbow, and indeed it is a similar weather phenomenon to that of the rainbow in most respects, a fogbow, as the arc in the photo is more commonly known, is, as the name suggests, notably different to behold. Fogbow is the preferred name because using the term white rainbow is actually somewhat inaccurate. From a distance, and without careful examination, a fogbow may indeed appear completely white. However, this is not so. Whilst the bow only consists of weak colours, it has more than one of them, including a reddish outer edge and a bluish inner one. The reasons the colours are so weak as compared with a typical rainbow is due to the dimensions of the water droplets that cause fog, which are considerably smaller than those produced by other forms of precipitation. Indeed, in many cases, the water droplets are so small that the entire fogbow can appear white. There is a direct correlation between the droplet size and colour vivacity, you see, so the smaller the droplets, the weaker the colours. However, a closer inspection will reveal that, though faint, the colours are present. No fogbow is ever, therefore, in the strictest sense, a white rainbow. Because fog is essentially low cloud, it is hardly surprising that the phenomenon is also frequently visible from aircrafts, typically when they are flying above clouds, looking downwards, if you like. Such fogbows are often given the alternative name cloudbows, for obvious reasons. Another name for fogbows was given to them by mariners, who tend to encounter the phenomenon regularly out at sea. To them, they are sea dogs. Fogbows are also occasionally visible at night time, when they are known as lunar fogbows. But why does droplet size have such an impact on coloration? Well, as I may have mentioned, fogbows are formed in much the same way as rainbows. Here are the basic steps. First, white light enters the water droplet. As it does so, it is divided into its seven different colours due to a process called dispersion. The different colours of light refract or change direction after entering the droplet at slightly different rates. Therefore, when the seven separate waves of light then get reflected off the inside of the droplet, they each go in a similar but slightly different direction, emerging to form the familiar large, colourful arc of the rainbow. The difference with fogbows is that the light is not refracted, however. Whilst refraction is at work in large water droplets to change the direction of light, the tiny droplets found in fog cause light to diffract instead. In simple terms, the process of diffraction involves breaking the light waves up and spreading them out into many different directions. The diffracted light produces weaker colours and the familiar broader and paler arc of the fogbow. Knowing what we do now about fogbows, it's unsurprising, therefore, that the photographer who captured the striking image that provoked such interest when we posted it on our website and forums was in the Scottish Highlands at the time of capture. After all, fog is a very frequent weather event in mountainous and hilly regions where there are often stark temperature contrasts. For the same reason, spectacular fogbows are regularly seen over Arctic waters too. Indeed, if you find you now have a taste for fogbows and a hankering to find more, you'd do well.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio program in which two people, Michelle Evans and Fred Knowles, are discussing the results of a recent government election. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
A warm welcome to Michelle Evans and Fred Knowles, who are joining me to discuss the state of affairs in Parliament since the election. Michelle, what is going to happen?
I think we will have to return to the polls. No party has a clear majority, so it's going to be impossible to form a government.
I fundamentally disagree. The people have spoken. I believe the parties have a responsibility to compromise so that a coalition government can be formed. That is clearly what the voters want.
I admire your faith in the democratic system, Fred. However, I fear agreement is extremely unlikely. We must be realistic. After all, the parties are ideologically opposed. There is no starting point for them to even open discussions.
There is the mandate the voters gave them, Michelle.
Perhaps the electorate should have more carefully considered the consequences of the way they voted, Fred. It is a very difficult situation.
I think you give them too little credit, Michelle. I believe this election result was very deliberate. It was their way of telling the parties that they are tired of the old politics of extremes. The voters have an appetite for a centrist agenda. They want the right and left side to meet in the middle and compromise their philosophies.
Fred, barely 50% of the electorate voted. I think you are trying too hard to be positive about this result. For me, it is a very sad time indeed for politics in our country.
Yes, the turnout was extremely disappointing on face value, Michelle. But look at the finer details. What I found very satisfying and extremely surprising was the proportion of young voters who turned out. Traditionally, this voting group normally has the highest level of voter apathy. Yet, as we can see from the turnout, a huge number of young people engaged with the political process. That is cause for optimism, surely.
I think it was largely coincidental. You are giving it too much importance. The election was held at the weekend, where it normally takes place midweek. More young people were, consequently, at home. Therefore, it was easier for them to get to the voting stations.
That might account for a slight increase, but not the level of participation we actually saw from young voters, which was huge.
That brings us to the other demographics, though, does it not? Why was there such a sharp drop in voter participation amongst more mature groups?
I think it is because these people are already well represented. They were content. They didn't feel the need to engage. From their perspective, they were already being well looked after.
I agree to some extent with that. Politicians have a nasty habit of pandering to the groups they know typically vote in and decide elections, such as pensioners, for example. I believe, therefore, that there was a protest vote here by young people. They deliberately went for the opposite of what the current political system represents, so that the politicians would finally have to stand up and take notice of them. That is why we have seen such a shift from the traditionally popular conservative parties. Young people decided to lean in the other direction.
How did you both vote, incidentally, if I may be so bold as to ask?
Well, I voted with the young people, of course.
Naturally, Fred. Your politics is well known from the articles you write for the Herald. So whatever their reasons for voting, protest or otherwise, we already know yours were purely political. I actually voted for none of the main players, Dominic. I would typically be inclined to vote for the more conservative parties Fred says the pensioners tend to support, but, and I guess in a way this is my own form of protest, I instead voted for a centrist party. I'm sick of the divisive politics we have in this country. So although I'm hugely disappointed with the election turnout and result, if it creates a change in how we do politics in this country in the long term, that will be a very good thing.
We shall see. Now, another interesting story that's come.
Now you will hear part three again.
A warm welcome to Michelle Evans and Fred Knowles, who are joining me to discuss the state of affairs in Parliament since the election. Michelle, what is going to happen?
I think we will have to return to the polls. No party has a clear majority, so it's going to be impossible to form a government.
I fundamentally disagree. The people have spoken. I believe the parties have a responsibility to compromise so that a coalition government can be formed. That is clearly what the voters want.
I admire your faith in the democratic system, Fred. However, I fear agreement is extremely unlikely. We must be realistic. After all, the parties are ideologically opposed. There is no starting point for them to even open discussions.
There is the mandate the voters gave them, Michelle.
Perhaps the electorate should have more carefully considered the consequences of the way they voted, Fred. It is a very difficult situation.
I think you give them too little credit, Michelle. I believe this election result was very deliberate. It was their way of telling the parties that they are tired of the old politics of extremes. The voters have an appetite for a centrist agenda. They want the right and left side to meet in the middle and compromise their philosophies.
Fred, barely 50% of the electorate voted. I think you are trying too hard to be positive about this result. For me, it is a very sad time indeed for politics in our country.
Yes, the turnout was extremely disappointing on face value, Michelle. But look at the finer details. What I found very satisfying and extremely surprising was the proportion of young voters who turned out. Traditionally, this voting group normally has the highest level of voter apathy. Yet, as we can see from the turnout, a huge number of young people engaged with the political process. That is cause for optimism, surely.
I think it was largely coincidental. You are giving it too much importance. The election was held at the weekend, where it normally takes place midweek. More young people were, consequently, at home. Therefore, it was easier for them to get to the voting stations.
That might account for a slight increase, but not the level of participation we actually saw from young voters, which was huge.
That brings us to the other demographics, though, does it not? Why was there such a sharp drop in voter participation amongst more mature groups?
I think it is because these people are already well represented. They were content. They didn't feel the need to engage. From their perspective, they were already being well looked after.
I agree to some extent with that. Politicians have a nasty habit of pandering to the groups they know typically vote in and decide elections, such as pensioners, for example. I believe, therefore, that there was a protest vote here by young people. They deliberately went for the opposite of what the current political system represents, so that the politicians would finally have to stand up and take notice of them. That is why we have seen such a shift from the traditionally popular conservative parties. Young people decided to lean in the other direction.
How did you both vote, incidentally, if I may be so bold as to ask?
Well, I voted with the young people, of course.
Naturally, Fred. Your politics is well known from the articles you write for the Herald. So whatever their reasons for voting, protest or otherwise, we already know yours were purely political. I actually voted for none of the main players, Dominic. I would typically be inclined to vote for the more conservative parties Fred says the pensioners tend to support, but, and I guess in a way this is my own form of protest, I instead voted for a centrist party. I'm sick of the divisive politics we have in this country. So although I'm hugely disappointed with the election turnout and result, if it creates a change in how we do politics in this country in the long term, that will be a very good thing.
We shall see. Now, another interesting story that's come.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts in which athletes discuss their sporting lives. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H how each speaker started their profession. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H how each speaker feels about their present situation. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
Growing up in a family of athletes, I suppose it was only natural that I would follow in their footsteps. It's in the genes, after all. But I never had my father's love of football and was not as talented as my mother at squash, though it was through that latter sport that I eventually found my way into tennis. Rather a late starter, it must be said, only picking up a racket for the first time aged 12. But I immediately took to it like a duck to water, as if I had been playing all my life. When I turned pro, I did become somewhat, well, very disheartened at my lack of progress through the ranks. But I've yet to fall out of love with the sport, and I believe that although I presently struggle to make ends meet, through hard work, determination, and no shortage of natural talent, I can turn things around.
Speaker 2.
Hailing from a family of couch potatoes and nerds, it was pure fluke that I ever got into sports. A friend in primary school constantly raved about badminton, and I suppose her enthusiasm was quite infectious, rather than tiresome. So off I went along with her one day and joined the club, much to the bewilderment of my family, who thought they were raising a rocket scientist. I guess I'm the black sheep. However, pride in my achievements is in no short supply, and they're genuinely ecstatic for me. For I have more or less tasted instant gratification. Success has been swift, and with it financial security for life has been guaranteed, not just for me, but for all my close family. To know that I have their full backing, though, is what counts more than anything else.
Speaker 3.
I fell into the river while fishing with my older sister and nearly drowned when I was 3. Luckily, she was an excellent swimmer, and she got to me in time, despite the strong current. But the incident prompted my parents to start taking me to swimming lessons from there on. Needless to say, it took me a long time to overcome my fear of the water. And, truth told, I still to this day do not feel 100% comfortable. However, my talent shone through from the start. I was a natural. That much was clear. I have been competing at the highest amateur level now for several years, and my next port of call is the Olympics, where I'm thrilled to say I'm considered a genuine medal prospect. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Speaker 4.
My aunt died tragically in a racing incident while I was growing up, so many people question my logic concerning my decision to choose the same path as her and go into motor racing myself. However, she was a first-class go-kart driver and could have achieved great things. I was immensely proud of her, not only for her achievements, but also for leading the way for women in the sport. To me, it always made perfect sense to follow her into the sport that she loved, which I did as soon as I could legally sit behind the wheel. I still think about her every time I race, and I dedicated my kart championship win last year to her, when I became the youngest victor in the competition's history. I know she would be so proud. Next, I'm aiming to become the youngest F1 driver and progress to the top of the elite field.
Speaker 5.
People think to be a skydiver, you must be some sort of crazed adrenaline junkie. Well, sure, I get a kick out of it, but that's not the reason why I chose this sport. As a child, growing up, I always had a fascination with birds, and birdwatching was my favourite hobby. The two activities might seem very disconnected, but not to me. I always wished I could soar through the sky like a bird. So when I discovered skydiving at university, I was immediately fascinated and hooked. Friends say it's dangerous, and what about all the fatalities? But little do they realise you're more likely to get injured crossing the street. I'm a professional now, and to begin with I made a living doing tandem jumps, but nowadays I'm a stunt diver. It's much more lucrative, and I get bragging rights when I occasionally appear on the big screen.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
Growing up in a family of athletes, I suppose it was only natural that I would follow in their footsteps. It's in the genes, after all. but I never had my father's love of football and was not as talented as my mother at squash, though it was through that latter sport that I eventually found my way into tennis. Rather a late starter, it must be said, only picking up a racket for the first time aged 12. But I immediately took to it like a duck to water, as if I had been playing all my life. When I turned pro, I did become somewhat, well, very disheartened at my lack of progress through the ranks. But I've yet to fall out of love with the sport, and I believe that although I presently struggle to make ends meet, through hard work, determination, and no shortage of natural talent, I can turn things around.
Speaker 2.
Hailing from a family of couch potatoes and nerds, it was pure fluke that I ever got into sports. A friend in primary school constantly raved about badminton, and I suppose her enthusiasm was quite infectious, rather than tiresome. So off I went along with her one day and joined the club, much to the bewilderment of my family, who thought they were raising a rocket scientist. I guess I'm the black sheep. However, pride in my achievements is in no short supply, and they're genuinely ecstatic for me, for I have more or less tasted instant gratification. Success has been swift, and with it financial security for life has been guaranteed, not just for me, but for all my close family. To know that I have their full backing, though, is what counts more than anything else.
Speaker 3.
I fell into the river while fishing with my older sister and nearly drowned when I was 3. Luckily, she was an excellent swimmer, and she got to me in time, despite the strong current. But the incident prompted my parents to start taking me to swimming lessons from there on. Needless to say, it took me a long time to overcome my fear of the water. And, truth told, I still to this day do not feel 100% comfortable. However, my talent shone through from the start. I was a natural. That much was clear. I have been competing at the highest amateur level now for several years, and my next port of call is the Olympics, where I'm thrilled to say I'm considered a genuine medal prospect. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Speaker 4.
My aunt died tragically in a racing incident while I was growing up, so many people question my logic concerning my decision to choose the same path as her and go into motor racing myself. However, she was a first-class go-kart driver and could have achieved great things. I was immensely proud of her, not only for her achievements, but also for leading the way for women in the sport. To me, it always made perfect sense to follow her into the sport that she loved, which I did as soon as I could legally sit behind the wheel. I still think about her every time I race, and I dedicated my kart championship win last year to her, when I became the youngest victor in the competition's history. I know she would be so proud. Next, I'm aiming to become the youngest F1 driver and progress to the top of the elite field.
Speaker 5.
People think to be a skydiver, you must be some sort of crazed adrenaline junkie. Well, sure, I get a kick out of it, but that's not the reason why I chose this sport. As a child, growing up, I always had a fascination with birds, and birdwatching was my favourite hobby. The two activities might seem very disconnected, but not to me. I always wished I could soar through the sky like a bird. So when I discovered skydiving at university, I was immediately fascinated and hooked. Friends say it's dangerous, and what about all the fatalities? But little do they realise you're more likely to get injured crossing the street. I'm a professional now, and to begin with I made a living doing tandem jumps, but nowadays I'm a stunt diver. It's much more lucrative, and I get bragging rights when I occasionally appear on the big screen.
That is the end of part 4. In the actual test, there would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.